You're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com.
Short Story Geeks podcast, episode 001, April 19th, 2011. Sponsored by Gnome Co. Publications, the hardest working gnomes on the web, at gnomecopublications.com. That's Gnome Co. with a G. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first show of the Short Story Geeks podcast. I am the Niche, and with me here I've got...
I'm Buck Turner.
And I'm Graveyard Greg.
And the three of us collectively are the Short Story Geeks. So, we're going to start the show with a slightly different format from what our eventual format is going to be. This is more of an introduction than anything else. And so I'll start by introducing each of us. For myself, like I say, I am the Niche. I'm also known in some corners as John Roby, but you don't have to go by that if you don't want to. I have a website at Niche.com. I also have webcomics at SuburbanJungle.com and Mopsy.com. And my connection to short stories is basically I love to read them. I love to write them. If you go to Niche.com, you can see a couple of my stories. And, you know, I've been a reader all of my life. Short stories, for me at least, have a great get in, get out, and you're done, and where's the next story thing going on. Particularly if you read a bunch of them all connected, something like Sherlock Holmes or Conan stories or something like that, you get a nice extended narrative that's easy to eat in small pieces. So that's one of the reasons I'm interested in doing this podcast. How about you, Buck?
Well, I am actually an editor, so as far as connection to short stories go, well, certainly I've been reading them for, you know, just about as long as I've been reading, but also I do currently put together, technically I'm the editor, the anthology Roar, which is a short fiction anthology featuring anthropomorphic animal characters. As far as why short stories there, couple of reasons here. Number one, you know, it's easy way to get a lot of different authors, you know, plugged into one book, get a good sense of, you know, different styles, communities, different audiences, bring them together into one thing and introduce them to something new. And also it just is a lot easier to edit than a big long novel project that you are basically living with. And you know, when you're the editor and not the writer, it's a little odd to be living in somebody else's book for so long. It's nice to be able to kind of shoot back and forth between the different projects and kind of move on to something entirely different, you know, for the next year.
How about you, Greg?
Well, I like to write, of course, and my website is graveyardgreg.com. I also write a webcomic called Carpe Diem at cdcomic.com. I also write a webcomic called Dungeons and Denizens at dungeond.com. And I write, yes, you guessed it, another webcomic called Gaming Guardians at gamingguardians.com. And then, of course, I write a couple of others, but we don't talk about that. I am technically also the editor of, I guess you could call it, Roar's sister, Fang. It gets a little blue sometimes, though, if you know what I mean. And most likely, though, I deal with the slush pile. I read all the short stories, and then I hand them over to the other editor saying, here, look at this. Let's see if you like it.
You're the first gateway there?
I'm the first gateway.
How did you get roped into that?
I made the mistake of telling Alex, Alex, we need Fang Volume 4 to finally come out. I will help you.
I see. So you volunteered yourself into the slush pile reader.
I have volunteered myself. And the fun part is, most of those stories have been very enjoyable. Some of them actually made me go, I can't believe it ended that way. And then some of them made me think, I can't believe it ended that way.
So I'm curious about that. As the slush pile reader, do you send along any recommendations to the editor? Like, this one would be good if it hadn't ended that way or anything like that? Or just hand it off to them and let them make their own choices?
I usually just hand it off to them so that they, you know, so I don't influence their, you know, opinions of it. I just let them know, it's like, hey, this is pretty good. Read it.
Okay.
Whether or not that's the right way of doing it, I don't know. This is the first time I've ever been a Flush editor.
So it's your way of doing it, whether it's right or not. Huh?
Yeah, right or wrong, it's how I do it.
Okay. All right, so let's talk about why we chose short stories, short fiction for a podcast topic. I mean, there's a lot of podcasts out there, and there's a lot of fiction out there. I sort of started the bringing together process on this with the idea that short stories would be a great way to give us focus without constraining us to a specific genre or a specific set of genres or even just a general type of fiction. You know, the short stories can be about anything. There's anthologies out there about vampires, there's anthologies about romance, there's anthologies about vampire romance, there's anthologies about science fiction, there's anthologies about mysteries. And, you know, it just goes back as far as you want to go, as far as fiction is concerned. A lot of my personal stuff is from the pulp era in the 30s and 40s, which was a very big time for short stories. But at the same time, there's a lot of new stuff coming out now. There seems to be a resurgence in short fiction, especially with the various electronic formats, which is why I thought now would be a good time to start talking about short fiction.
Well, I'd like to agree with you on that, because there is a resurgence of short fiction. I don't know if I could base this on Smashwords, but Smashwords is a place where you can get the electronic editions of short stories, novels, novellas, you know, those things. And as a publisher of short stories, I've noticed it's taking a long time to convert my short stories into an electronic format. So I think there's resurgence. Whether or not it's short fiction, I don't know. I'd like to think so.
Okay.
Well, and I think a lot of it, as far as coming into its own, really has been the internet era, with, you know, just a lot more people getting into showing off their writing. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's more people writing now than there are before, though that may be the case. But now there's a lot of places where you can go and just kind of throw things up, throw it out there, see what sticks, you know, build your own little audience without having to necessarily fight through the submission process at, you know, an analog or, you know, the big short story fiction names that are no longer with us for the most part because of certain other economic realities, and then fight your way through that kind of an audience. It's a lot more, you know, democratic now that anybody can put stuff up. And I know that finding a lot of short stories online, you know, really changed the way I saw a lot of things and, you know, introduced me to a lot of people that I would not have otherwise known or met or, you know, ever hung out with.
So instead of, say, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, somebody with a typewriter hanging out would write a short story and just sort of stick it in their sock drawer and never see the light of day, that's what you're talking about. And these days they put it on a blog and they can build an audience out of it.
Well, there's that. There's, you know, a lot of authors who would love to make it, would love to publish, but maybe back in the day, they couldn't get through a screening process, they weren't writing the right kind of thing, they weren't, you know, friends with the editor to get into the magazine.
Uh-huh.
And now, you don't necessarily have to, you know, get that publishing career, get that story accepted to a big magazine for a lot of people to read it. You go to a lot of sites on the internet where you can read things, and maybe they're not all good, maybe they're not, you know, great or even publish worthy, but they're good enough, you know. And you can, you know, when you're an editor, you can see different ways. You can see the diamond in the rough. You can see the kernel of a story that's in there that's interesting, even when you can overlook certain flaws and things. And then, you know, at the same time, you'll find, you know, kind of literally that diamond there every now and again where, you know, it's just somewhere thrown up on a website, thrown up on an anthology, you know, or just kind of fiction site with a lot of different noise out there, and you'll find something really amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, there's another facet to that, though, which is sort of the wild and woolly nature of the internet makes it easy to, say, get into fan fiction, which is, fan fiction is an interesting beast. And it's not something we're going to talk a lot about here on Short Story Geeks. My intention is that we'll talk mostly about new projects as opposed to, you know, the adventures of Mary Sue. But a lot of writers, I think, these days are probably, well, probably back in the old days too, sort of worked out how to write decently writing fanfic. You know, I used to write, long before the internet, I used to write Star Wars fanfic just for myself and my friends, and Star Trek fanfic also, just because that's the kind of geek I was, which taught me a lot about how to write. And these days, I would never, you know, show it to the world, but there are people out there who do, and there are people out there who started out that way who've become better writers since then.
Yeah, fanfic is quite the, or can be, I should say, can be quite the gateway drug. I know a lot of the early online stuff that I read started out as reading a lot of fan fiction, and then as a lot of those writers kind of matured and grew up, a lot of them kind of moved on to say, you know what, I don't need that crutch, or I don't need that framework that I started with of the fan fiction, and really moved on to other things, creating their own characters, and kind of after playing in that sandbox, figured out, you know, a lot more how to make their own stuff better.
Well, that's a good segue into, you know, sort of what we're going to talk about on the podcast generally. I think one of the big things that we're going to probably do a lot of, at least I have in mind to do, is discuss or review specific stories or anthologies, whether they're our own work or somebody else's work. You know, if you go to Amazon, you can see all kinds of new anthologies coming out all the time, or, you know, any publisher, really. Just anything along those lines that's interesting. It doesn't have to be new. It doesn't have to be coming out. I have a couple of things lined up for future podcasts of talking about H.P. Lovecraft, who hasn't written a new thing since 1940-something because he's been dead, you know.
So that's a lame excuse.
Given that it's Lovecraft, I wouldn't put it past him to have a story turn up at this point, and I imagine it would be quite entertaining if it did.
Yeah, because, I mean, Mark Twain finally published his autobiography. He just did it recently. H.P. Lovecraft's a slacker.
You know, J.R.R. Tolkien is still publishing, despite having been dead for years.
You see?
And I'm also, we'll talk about just any sort of general short story related news. You know, if you set up, you can set up Google alerts for all sort of topics, and so I've got one that's searching the web for new stuff about short stories, and there's always something new to talk about. There's competitions, there's solicitations, there's, you know, new compilations coming out all the time. So, you know, for any given podcast, we'll probably just grab a couple of those and focus on them. Speaking of solicitations, I have a note here, Buck, about solicitation.
Yes, speaking of soliciting, I am soliciting, not that way. Roar Volume 4 is actually currently looking for short stories for the publication. We're hoping to make it out around January of next year. That's kind of our general theme. This year was about a month behind, but still not too bad. The theme this time around, we're looking for short stories that are exploring the idea of celebrity. As I mentioned kind of briefly, Roar is it's a general audience's anthology, and it focuses on anthropomorphic fiction.
Or, you know, furry, as it's often called. Yeah.
Furry, yeah. And so we're looking for things. I have a kind of a tentative deadline of the end of July, so that this fall I can then start to work on, you know, going through my own slush pile, contacting everybody, and then starting the process of actual editing, getting everything together. Because I pretty much with Roar, it is me from the first solicitation email that gets sent out until the final period goes into InDesign, typesetting and everything, and then it gets shipped off to the printer.
So you don't have a Greg reading your slush pile?
No. I read kind of ridiculously fast, so, you know, in a typical evening I can, you know, get through 3 to 5 short stories that are published, are submitted or published, you know, generally. So, you know, I do pretty good, and as of yet, there haven't been enough solicitations for Roar to really kind of bury me, as much as I would kind of love for that that problem to fall into my lap. Hasn't happened yet.
So basically, people, Bring your short stories to Buck.
Yes.
Bury him.
Give Buck a bunch of cool short stories. I will say, I am working on an idea for one myself. People who are familiar with the Roar series will probably know that both Greg and I have been in previous anthologies, and I at least am hoping to be in another one, but we'll have to see how that goes.
Get me something good, and I'm sure that we'll find a place for it.
Well, I'm doing my best. I have, you know, the entire Suburban Jungle cast to work from, so I have a natural a natural base of characters who want to talk about celebrity. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's see. Other stuff we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about tips for writers and for editors. You know, as we have a couple of editors here, we will occasionally give you ideas of what to do and what not to do, and you know, how to maximize your chances of finding the editor something that the editor wants so that they will buy it from you. And also, we're looking for things to plug. If you have a writing project you would like us to talk about, you can send it to us at shortstorygeeks.com. We're also on Twitter as @shortstorygeeks, so you can send a direct message there, and that should get our attention. Or if you would like to be a guest, I have some tentative interviews set up for future episodes, but I don't want to actually announce them until they're in the can, because I've been burned by that kind of thing before. And we're always looking for comments. You can leave comments on the website, or you can send an email. You can send an email to me, theneach@gmail.com. Buck or Greg?
My primary email address is going to be buckcturner@baddogbooks.com.
You can find me, GraveyardGreg, @gamingguardians.com.
All right, so that's our sort of general introduction, and fortunately, future episodes will not have this section, so you won't have to listen to us blather about why we're interested in short stories over and over again. But hopefully you will find some interest in it this time around. And we'll just have a quick little message here, and then we'll go on to the discussion section of this episode.
Listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com has been clinically proven to make you smarter and more attractive. That's shortstorygeeks.com.
Not actually clinically proven. May cause confusion or spontaneous fits of giggling. Void where prohibited.
All right, well, we're back, and for discussion today, one of the things we wanted to talk about was, as we mentioned in the introduction, sort of the electronic distribution of short stories, and what kind of things are happening, and what implications it may have for the future. You know, anybody who's on the internet and is interested in short stories probably knows that there are Kindle one-offs, there's Smashwords, there's little iPhone apps. One of my particular favorites is one called Steampunk Tales, which you can find at steampunktales.com. They distribute it in just about any way they can think of on the web or electronically. When I first came upon it, it was as an iPhone app. They just had every issue. It's like a pulp magazine, except instead of being printed on pulp paper, which is how pulp magazines got the name, each issue was an app for your iPhone or your iPod or whatever device you happen to like to use. And the apps were like $2.99 each. I think that's still their going rate for each issue. And it was just a collection of steampunk short stories, which I thought was a very neat idea. And nowadays you can go to Steampunk Tales and find just about any kind of method. They have it on Smashwords. They have it on Amazon. And they have all sorts of links on their site for different ways to read it. So they're very aggressive about, we don't care what platform you use, we just want you to read our stuff. On a similar note, there's a new sort of pulp horror magazine being created. It's called Arcane, Penny Dreadfuls for the 21st Century. And that's at arcanemagazine.com. And that one is just starting out, and it is put together. Let me look it up here. It is put together by Sandy Peterson, who, if anybody's involved in the gaming scene, would probably know as the person who created the original Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. And worked a lot on RuneQuest and all sorts of stuff like that. So Sandy Peterson, within the sort of geek crowd, is a pretty important figure. And Arcane is available in all sorts of formats. They've just put out issue number one. And that definitely looks very cool. And again, the idea there is they're trying to put it out in any kind of format that people will read. I think the only format it's not in is paper, because nobody buys paper magazines anymore, especially not paper fiction magazines, except for Ellery Queen and Asimov Science Fiction. And those, I don't know how many people actually do buy those. I see them in Borders and Barnes & Noble all the time, but I never actually see anyone buy them. And another e-book anthology coming out right now, one that's particular interest to me, is Diane Duane has a new one coming out, and that one is called Uptown Local and Other Interventions, and it's a collection of various short stories, some of which are related to her regular works, and some of them are just one-offs. No Star Trek fiction in there, I'm afraid, for those of you who are fans of Diane Duane's Star Trek books. However, if you're a fan of her Young Wizards series, there's only two Young Wizards short stories in existence, and they're both in this anthology. And I have a link to that in the show notes, so people can check that out if they're interested. And Greg, you wanted to talk about someone who's big in internet distribution.
Yes, I want to talk about Cory Doctorow. And Cory, if I mispronounce your name, and if you happen to be listening to this podcast, please forgive me. Do not smite me. According to him, he is a Canadian blogger, journalist, and science fiction author who serves as co-editor of the blog Boing Boing.
Boing Boing is
and
pretty
according
huge.
To Yeah, I've never been there. Sorry, Cory. I'll try to go there next time.
No, now he's going to smite you.
But he is a proponent of the Creative Commons organization, and he uses this license on some of his short stories and his novels. And the common themes of his work include digital rights management, file sharing, and scarcity.
Start again.
You're welcome.
And, okay, let's try this again. Some common themes of his work include digital rights management, file sharing, and, help me with this one, Buck?
Post-scarcity economics.
Thank you, because I could tell a brain part was forming. Post-scarcity. I pronounced it right. Economics. Okay.
So what does that mean? Do you know post-scarcity? What does that mean?
So basically that means what happens now that you have everything that you want at your fingertips, kind of when the internet model of distribution and production and creation, when that spills out into to other forms. So how does economics work when suddenly, instead of, you know, one record company, you have, you know, 100 million people putting out their work for free on the internet? How do they get paid? How do they make a living? What happens to the record companies? And so on and so forth. That's just kind of the first real world example of it, and he takes it a lot farther.
What he said.
Okay.
I would have just said, you know, definition is when, you know, things such as goods, services, and information are free or practically free. Long story short.
Yeah, you know, something I used to wonder about with Star Trek was they have this ship full of replicators that can make anything they want just on demand. There's an episode where they're, like, trying to choose a birthday present for somebody, and they were looking through a catalog of stuff they were going to pull out of the replicator. It seemed like the most ridiculous idea to me that, you know, why would you create something out of a replicator that the person could just call up out of their own replicator if you're wanting it to be a gift, you know what I mean?
That's why it's so damn hard to birthday shop for people in Star Trek.
I guess so.
Like, what do you get him? He's got the catalog. If he wanted it, he would have it.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a lot of that. You got to find some way to make it personal to people.
Yeah. So I guess that would be post-scarcity economics at its most extreme.
I wouldn't necessarily say that, but if you ever get a chance here, the book that really kind of goes a lot into that, and that was really kind of made a name for that, would be Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, which isn't short, so that's about all I'll say about it at the moment.
It's not short, but you'll probably finish it in record time because it just reads so freaking quickly. It is just that good.
Cool. So tell us about some of Cory Doctorow's short fiction then.
So the recent one that I have read is called I, Robot, which I think is a
Wow.
Yep.
I haven't seen that one yet.
That's awesome.
When I was looking at it, I saw I, Robot by him in one of his anthologies called Overclocked. And then I saw I, Robot. And I'm thinking, I have to read this. So, this story is part of Cory Doctorow's 2007 short story collection, Overclocked, Stories of the Future Present. And it's available for free online. You can just go to his website, craphound.com.
Craphound.com, great URL.
And one of the things that I found interesting about the Creative Commons license, he says, in the words of Woody Guthrie, this song is copyrighted in U.S. under seal of copyright 15-4085 for a period of 28 years, and anybody caught singing it without our permission will be mighty good friends of ours. Because we don't give a turn. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, rewrote it, that's all we wanted to do. So basically you could use any portions of this short story and, you know, put it in one of your own, I guess. He doesn't care. He wrote it. He published it. Boom. He's done.
It's just a present to the world, huh?
It's a present to the world. And what I liked about iRobot is the common theme was uplifting. Apparently, this is a sentient AI. He is a robot. And apparently, humans uplifted themselves into something called the new sphere. And occasionally, they download themselves back into these meat puppets. The problem came is when a coral reef got uplifted, and it basically says, hey, I don't like you.
Uh-oh.
And there's when the trouble started. You'd have to read it for yourself to understand it. It is an excellent short story. Kind of spooky, though, if you can uplift a coral reef.
Yeah. As a rising tide lifts all rowboats, then.
But yeah, he's a science fiction writer that seems to... I would almost say he's a... What's the word I'm looking for where it's science fiction that's a couple of years advanced? It's very close to our own present. I'm not sure.
I believe speculative fiction is the...
That's the word. Thank you. Yeah, jeez, my vocabulary is on vacation.
Genre buzzword you're looking for.
I've also heard him called a writer 2.0. So with the play on the web 2.0.
Oh,
it's like I've seen reviews calling him the... You know, the first writer of the web 2.0 age. You know, you've got the older guard that really with their writings influenced the people that created the internet, and now you've got Cory Doctorow who has the internet and saying, okay, now that we've got this, what's the next step?
That sounds good.
His genres, he does like science fiction. According to his page, he also likes post-cyberpunk, which I guess iRobot could be considered post-cyberpunk.
Mm-hmm.
And the boy has won some awards. The John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer, the John W. Campbell Memorial Award, the Prometheus Award, the Sunburst Award. He's probably won the award.
The award. So he's like Harlan Ellison, the next generation. Is that what
Harlan Ellison, only a kinder, gentler Harlan Ellison, I think.
And
no
we'll
offense,
see if
Harlan.
We'll see if he's still like that in 30 years, right?
Apparently he could also be the Frank Zappa of science fiction, because his one daughter named Posey Emmeline Fibonacci Nautilus Taylor Doctorow.
Nice.
That's a mouthful.
Wow. No, that's supreme indecision. We couldn't figure out which person to name her after her for her middle name, so we just put them all in there.
Yeah, but Fibonacci?
Yeah, Fibonacci. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5. Eureka.
All right.
But yes, if you like short story, you like post-cyberpunk science fiction, and you want it to be clever, go to craphound.com. In fact, read the short story, Craphound. You're going to like that one as well, but that's another review.
Okay. So we'll put that link in the show notes, and that sounds good. Well, there's one more sort of... it's not exactly short fiction, but it is definitely short, and it's also not true. And that is silly Twitter accounts. And the one I'm thinking of specifically is Drunk Hulk. And the reason I'm thinking of Drunk Hulk is because the person behind Drunk Hulk, whose name is, I'm not sure how to pronounce it exactly, it looks like Christian Dumais. Dumais?
I like Dumais.
Dumais, maybe.
Very fancy.
Dumais. Well, anyway, he has recently been interviewed on Writing Insight blog, which is a blog about your soon-to-be favorite authors, and they specialize in new authors or authors who are still working on crawling their way up the charts, so to speak. And Christian was interviewed, like I say, for this blog, and he's become more well-known now as the guy who writes Drunk Hulk, than he was known for his writing, which you gotta wonder how he feels about that, but that's a very interesting little interview, and I'm going to post it in the show notes. I'm particularly interested in things where the something you put in as a toss-away gag becomes a lot more important than the big, heavy themes that you're working on. Have you guys ever encountered something like that?
Probably, but right now my brain's on vacation and it won't let me think of anything.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, but at the same time, a lot of Drunk Hulk's things, you know, for as short as they are, as much as you have to kind of cram for the 140 characters, they're actually very topical and insightful a lot of times.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. He is a very good writer, and you have to be a very good writer to come up with something that sets up an idea, plays with the idea, and then finishes it off elegantly in 140 characters or less. You know, like there's one that came out earlier this week. It's, "They cancel all my children. One life to live. Oprah quit. Drunk Hulk start run out of ironic reason to wake up." You know, it's extremely tight.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
That's one of the great things about Twitter is it really teaches you to economize what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, though. There can be a Twitter writer who writes these amazing, you know, 1 to 2 sentence things. It's not the same as a story, necessarily. So
that's very true.
And you can string a bunch of those together that are, you know, really good as sound bites, but, you know, don't hold together as a story. So can kind of cut both ways.
That's true. Yeah, well, certainly Twitter is not going to teach you how to write the great American novel by any stretch.
But it might get you a TV show.
That it might.
With William Shatner.
Well, Facebook will get you that anyway. Not Facebook. It was a blog, wasn't it?
No, it was a blog. No. It was Twitter. It was a Twitter account.
Twitter. Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, never mind. I'll just edit all of that out and post, and nobody will know that I said something that dumb.
Yeah, there's the one that will. There's a Twitter knockoff where you can only post if it's more than like 14,000 characters.
Oh my lord, what's that called? Mega Twitter?
I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I actually sat down and tried to write something that was 14,000 characters, and after about 20 minutes, I was about halfway through. I'm like, you know what? Never mind.
That's what
my God, why?
TLDR.com or
pretty
something
much.
Like that.
Pretty much.
Wow, that's impressive. No, I remember there was a big spoof going around. One of the creators of Twitter was going to come up with a new social media that wouldn't allow you to write vowels.
No, I liked the word processor for the very simple, clean interface word processor, where it shows one letter at a time. It's all, you know, no file bar, nothing, just one letter at a time. And then somebody coded it. It sounds like an XKCD joke, but...
Wow. Okay. Well, you guys have anything else you want to add to our discussion of electronic stuff? I mean, right now we've just sort of skimmed the surface, and I think more will come up as we go, but...
I totally think you should come up with TLDR.com, John. I really do.
Yeah, okay. I'll see what I can do. That's probably taken already. You know, some URL farmer is sitting on it, showing ads for, you know, stuff related to writing too much.
TLDR Network's homepage, under construction.
Lovely.
Sorry, Nietzsche, you missed out.
Ah! Well, there goes another career down the drain. All right, we'll have a little bumper here, and then we will go on to Buck Turner's Spotlight segment.
You're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com. Remember, it's the stories that are short, not the geeks. The geeks are actually pretty tall.
The funny pen of the ranting editor!
Do you think that's a little over the top?
That is freaking... awesome.
I mean, you've both been in books that I've put out. I don't think it's that bad, do
no,
you?
No, actually, I think it's very accurate. You had me in tears for, like, you know, 2 months.
Was that why it took so long to get that story back?
No, when I say by tears, I mean vodka. Lots and lots of vodka.
Mrs. Nietzsche wouldn't come back in the house for 2 days after that horse head in the bed.
Good to have friends in places across the country where authors are. Sometimes an editor needs tools. Sometimes that's a word processor, sometimes that's, you know, other things. But anyway, since this is the first episode and there probably won't be quite as many people reading here, I wanted to go off on something completely insane as an editor. A couple little tiny things that kind of drive me nuts. And they aren't deal breakers by any stretch. If you send in a story and don't follow, you know, kind of what I'm about to talk about, it's not necessarily, at least for me, going to kill you. I mean, I'm not going to not read a story or not, you know, accept a story because of these things. But little things that kind of irk me as an editor or make extra work for me. John and Greg, when did you learn to type, just out of curiosity?
I learned to type at summer school in 1982.
Yeah, so the question, how many spaces do you put after a period?
Well, let me think. One?
Yeah, there's a big thing about that. It was two on a typewriter and one on a word processor.
Yeah, because when I learned how to type, it was all with the monospace fonts. I learned to type pretty young myself, and learned on, you know, monospace Microsoft Works without a number after it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, learned again in school on an actual electric typewriter. So kind of growing up with the monospace fonts with the typewriter, it was always two. And so then you kind of getting into the actual typesetting of books and realizing, oh, gee, that's not the way it should be. And a lot of people were and still seem to be kind of taught to do two spaces after a period. And that, along with really any extra characters, certain word processors make funny characters when you're typing and formatting and things. So when I get submissions, it's really nice. There's no extraneous invisible punctuation. You know, the carriage returns in the weird places. There's some crazy non-breaking line space that Word will sometimes put in that screws up the justification. That stuff kind of drives me nuts.
Yeah, well, I know WordPerfect has a setting in it that will, if you put two spaces after a period, will erase one of them.
Yeah, I think there are various autocorrects that may or may not be enabled. And, you know, some things are going to go more than the others. You know, just in terms of what gets added into it, a lot of it you can kind of strip out by saving your work as an RTF instead of a doc or SDW or whatever else, which is also nice because you're never quite sure which software your editor is going to be reading on. So if it's an RTF, you can still do things like, you know, have some basic formatting, things like that. But it's not necessarily going to be, oh, well, now I've got to go download OpenOffice because Word doesn't like OpenOffice format or vice versa or anything like that. So it's just a nice thing here to do. And another thing that does drive me crazy is kind of font choice. It's not a common issue that I run across, but every now and again, because I really, you know, I mentioned before, I kind of do Roar from day one till it gets printed, and after it gets printed, going back and fixing the typos and printing one. So that means I do a lot of the typesetting, all the typesetting, the graphic design of the book, the layout of the book. And so between that and my art background, I'm kind of one of those insane people that just really gets into typography, which you don't want to be one of those people. I don't recommend it, but somebody has to do it or the book won't look good. And so when I get a submission in a font that's not, you know, kind of the normal font, it just kind of grates it. It's like, you know, I open up the file, I'm like, oh, I got to read that. And sure,
no, they do that to tell you in Comic Sans or something.
Yeah, Comic Sans Courier is, I don't know why, it's not necessarily my, you know, anyone's fault or anything. It just reminds me of those lazy college papers when you're like, what's the biggest font in the word processor? Courier New, and that's the biggest font in the word processor. So I'm going to use that. I don't know, just to me it looks ugly. And which is not to say that some other editor wouldn't absolutely adore you for putting your, you know, story into Courier New. And I know it's easy enough to go, you know, Control A and change a font, but you know, at the same time, you don't want your editor's gut reaction to opening up your story to be ew, which, you know, a bad font can potentially do if your editor is also a, you know, typesetter, book, you know, layout guy. So it's kind of a way to easily not do that is look at anything else put out by that editor or put out by that publisher, and you probably won't have the same font. I can just about guarantee you that you don't have the, you know, Adobe Pro font that costs $1 million that, you know, that the book gets sets in. But I can guarantee you, you got something close. And when it's, you know, close, it makes it easier to kind of read just because that's the font that you see every day. You know, I like a serif on me. That, you know, it's just me personally. You know, some people like the Helvetica, you know, the sans serif, but kind of look at what has been put out by where you're submitting. Look at their website. What kind of fonts do they use there? How do they present themselves? Which, you know, may or may not be 100% accurate with the individual editor you get, but, you know, kind of look at their product when you're submitting.
It seems to me that, well, the first place to check would just be to look for if there's any submission guidelines to talk about it. I know there are, especially for like places like Random House or the big publishers, they want it in something that looks like it was typewritten, because they have editors there who used to do everything with typewriter paper and are just used to it. So it always pays to look, because most houses, publishing houses, are very eager to tell you what they want, because they spend so much time looking at stuff they don't want.
Yeah. And that's the thing. A lot of the, especially a lot of the electronic places, they're, you definitely got to read it. It's important to know what they are asking for, what they're looking for. A lot of times they don't say as much about their technical, you know, guidelines, and even, you know, Roar doesn't put any limitations there. Because it's not going to stop me from reading something that gets submitted. I read everything, you know, no matter how good, no matter how bad, I read it all from start to finish. You never know when you're going to come across the second half of a story that would be really great if you just delete the first half. So I read everything, you know, fonts and all, but, and a lot of the other submissions I've seen, it, you know, they say, you know, here's the word count, here's the style we're looking for, here's the subject matter we're looking for, things like that. They don't talk a lot about the design because, you know, they're not, you're not going to send them a document and they're just going to cut and paste that onto a screen. They typeset it themselves. But at the same time, if you know your editors, if you really kind of know who you're submitting to, you know, look at what their books are in and give it to them in as close as a font as you can, because that's what they look at the most, and that's what they're going to be comfortable reading, and that's what their eyes are going to just kind of ease into. So they don't, you know, they aren't going to say, a lot of them, I should say, they aren't going to say, use this font or use these margins or, you know, justify or anything like that, but actually look at it and see what they are doing. And that's just kind of one way that you'll get, you know, subconsciously even a better reaction from an editor if they like the format you're sending it in. You know, whatever that may be for that particular editor, that's going to kind of give them a warm, fuzzy feeling before they read anything, just by the way the words look on the page.
All right. Okay, well, we're going to have another little bumper here. And
before we do the bumper, I have a request.
Yes.
I want to hear the opening for The Ranting Editor again. That was just awesome.
The Funny Pen of The Ranting Editor!
nature. I love it.
Well, I'm glad you like it.
Hello, this is James Mason. You're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com.
Not actually James Mason. James Mason has been dead since 1984. Void where prohibited.
Well, we're ready now to go into the intro for Short Story Geeks number one. And I would like to thank you guys for coming along, and I hope we're going to have a really good thing going here. And so here we're going to have a little tradition of the hosts get to do their own little plugs. For myself, I'm going to plug two things. First thing I'm going to plug is that my comic Never Never is finally out completely in book form. And you can go to mopsy.com, and there's a little link on the side there where you can get the books. You can get them individually, or you can get them as a package deal, which is a much better price. The package deal, I believe, is $28 plus shipping for both books. And I'm just very excited to finally have that out, because Never Never has been out a long time, but the first book came out in 1999 or 2000, and then the second book just did not come out for years, so that's finally available. The second thing I'm going to plug here is that I'm going to be guest of honor at Confuzzled in the UK in just a couple of weeks here. And that's going to be in Manchester, and you can go to, let me double check the URL here, I believe it's confuzzled.org.uk. I don't know if there's any pre-reg still going on. You can probably register in person if you happen to be in Manchester the weekend of May 7th. And so for all you UK folks out there, come by and say hello, and I will have Never Never books, and I will have some buttons, and I just would like to meet anybody who wants to come. Greg.
Me? Okay. Well, let me, according to the show notes, I am plugging my page at Smashboards. It's GraveyardGreg at Smashboards.com. It is the up-and-coming website if you want to publish fiction or if you want to get fiction. Come to Smashboards.com. Look for me, GraveyardGreg. And I'm going to say, when you hear this, go to Smashboards.com, enter the coupon CT63W, get Total Opposites, enter that code at checkout, and you'll get Total Opposites for free.
Give us that coupon one more time.
The coupon code is C as in cat, T as in terrific, 63W as in word. And I'd like to plug one more thing.
Go for it.
I am not going to be a guest of honor at any conventions this year. If you would like to change that, if you have a convention and want me as your guest of honor, email me, GraveyardGreg at GamingGuardians.com.
Wow, that was totally shameless, Greg.
I had one shameless thing. That's GraveyardGreg at GamingGuardians.com.
Right. Okay, Buck, how about you?
All right. So, a couple of things here. I've been plugging the Roar for submissions all show long. But also remember, there is Roar 1, 2, and 3 available for purchase. Roar 3 is brand new, and I think it is probably the best of them so far.
Doesn't the niche have a story in Roar 3?
You know, what? I think I remember writing something for Roar.
What's that story called, John?
Wow, what is that story called? It's been so long.
Oh,
that story is called Blackbird Singing in the Dead of Night, and it stars Squash and Stretch, the private detectives from Suburban Jungle.
Yes, so go out and pick up those books. The third one is really amazing, and the more people that pick them up, the more we can pay authors in the future books. So we like to pay authors because we think it's cool.
Wait, you pay authors?
Eventually.
Awesome. Totally awesome.
Wow. Cool.
Yes, yes, you will be getting paid soon. The quarter has ended. As we were recording, I saw a little pop-up on my feed here that Fur Planet is sending off royalty checks, so soon I will have funds to pay the authors, because really, I do pay them. Greg knows. Greg got paid.
Did you get paid, Greg?
Well, technically, I got paid in the best form of payment when it comes to writing for anthologies. I got paid in a week. I got a free copy of Roar Volume 2, and I tell you, best payment ever.
Yep. And my contact information, just in addition to BuckCTurner@baddogbooks.com, you can also see me on Twitter. I am at EditorBuck.
Okay.
Approach him carefully.
Yeah, because he might, you know, pull out his bloody pen, and then you'd be in big trouble.
Then you hear the lightning and the thunder.
Exactly.
Or you hear the thunder and see the lightning.
All right. If you would like to subscribe to the RSS feed for shortstorygeeks.com, there's a nice handy-dandy little link. If you go to shortstorygeeks.com, there's a picture of a coffee cup with an RSS logo mysteriously floating in it. All you have to do is click on that, and that will hook you up.
Is it true that when you click on the link, Nietzsche gets his copy?
Yes. Yes, that is true.
You are a terrible liar.
That was really unconvincing.
I'm sorry. I was blindsided by the question. But moving on. You can also contact us there at shortstorygeeks.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at shortstorygeeks. So come back in 2 weeks for the next show. That will be available on May 3rd. And we don't know what we're going to have for that yet exactly, but we'll work out something in the meantime. You can always follow the website for interesting little tidbits. I do a lot of retweeting short story news on the Twitter feed. And with that, we're going to call this show
Can we call it a podcast? I've always wanted to call the show a podcast.
Okay, and with that, we'll call this show a podcast.
We really need a better catchphrase.
Yeah, we do.
Got one? Go ahead, send it in.
Yeah,
please.
Please,
give us your ideas, or else we're going to have to come up with it ourselves.
Yeah, send your sign-off ideas to shortstorygeeks.com, and, well, we'll come up with something sooner or later. Thanks. Good night, everybody.
Say good night, Nietzsche.
Good night, Nietzsche.
Say good night, Buck.
Good night, Buck.
Good night, Greg.
Good night, Nietzsche.
Good night, John Boy.
Good night, Moon.
Good night already.
This has been episode 001 of the Short Story Geeks podcast with your hosts, The Nietzsche, Buck Turner, and Graveyard Greg, with additional material by Laurie Roby. Intro and outro music provided by the Rat City Brass at ratcitybrass.com. Incidental music provided by freemusicarchive.org and the PodSafe Music Network at musicalley.com. All music used with permission under the Creative Commons license or by its creator. Thanks for listening. Crunchy cookie creamy candy.
Rubber bubber baby funky.
Fail.
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 Arnold can do it, but I can't.
Well, now I know what the stinger at the end is going to be.